local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Dan Hoos from Sullivan County Government is here with the latest from Monticello, including an independent audit that shows the county revenues continue to exceed expenses, which is good, and more. A Honesdale native creates a new and improved map that more accurately depicts the deepest point of the Delaware River in Narrowsburg. We talked to Lisa Glover about why an inaccurate map annoyed her so much she decided to make a new one. And from Bach to rock with the cello, pushing the limits of this acoustic instrument to achieve the sounds of jazz, rock and roll, tangos, Broadway, and more. Our own classical kid is here. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. France's high-speed railway network has been hit by what officials are calling criminal acts of vandalism. It happened just hours before the opening ceremonies of the Paris Summer Olympics. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from London, where international rail links to the European continent have been affected.
Half of the trains carrying Olympic athletes to Paris via one Western line have been halted. Some athletes are missing the opening ceremony. The French prime minister says these were coordinated acts of sabotage, vandalism, and arson targeting the nerve centers of the country's rail system, crimes that carry up to 20 years in prison. Three out of four main rail lines are affected. But southeast of Paris, night maintenance crews spotted intruders on a section of tracks and alerted police, thwarting what officials say could have been another attack. Some 15 million Olympic visitors are expected in France, but authorities are now urging people not to go to train stations. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Vice President Harris has landed a big endorsement on her way to becoming the Democratic nominee for president. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, former President Barack Obama and former First Lady Michelle Obama are throwing their weight behind Harris's run.
In a video released by the campaign, Harris is seen answering a call on her cell.
Kamala!
Hello. Hi!
Hey there!
Both Obamas are on the line, offering their support.
We called to say Michelle and I couldn't be prouder to endorse you and to do everything we can to get you through this election and into the Oval Office.
The former First Lady added that this campaign is going to be historic. The Obamas are some of the last big-name Democrats to endorse Harris, capping a week where virtually everyone in the party, including convention delegates, lined up behind her. A person familiar with the process says the former president and Harris have been in regular touch. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
Stocks jumped on Wall Street this morning as inflation continues to ease. As NPR's Maria Aspen reports, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 600 points, or more than 1.5%, in morning trading.
There's more promising economic news this morning. Inflation eased slightly in June, according to a key indicator that's closely watched by the Federal Reserve. The Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index, or PCE, rose 2.5% in June from a year earlier. That's in line with expectations and adds to hopes that the Fed will start cutting interest rates as soon as September. Chip makers may be recovering from the week's brutal sell-off among big tech companies. Shares in NVIDIA and AMD opened up. And Southwest Airlines is ending its first-come, first-served seating policy. The airline says that its customers now want to know where they're sitting before they board its planes. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now up 621 points. You're listening to NPR. The National Interagency Fire Center says there are at least 89 large fires now burning in the United States. Oregon has the most large fires by far, nearly two dozen. The biggest active wildfire in the U.S. is burning in eastern Oregon. The Durkee Fire has burned nearly 450 square miles. Voice actors with the union SAG-AFTRA are preparing to go on strike against video game companies. As NPR's Mandalit Del Barco reports, contract talks have been underway for the last year and a half.
The strike is set to begin just after midnight Pacific time. The union's voice actors and performers whose movements are captured digitally say they will stop working on video game productions. The companies say they offered union members protections from the use of artificial intelligence, but members of SAG-AFTRA's negotiating committee say not everyone would have been protected.
What they are saying is that some of these performances, specifically for movement, is just data.
Video game performer Andy Norris argued that work like hers, done by human actors, should be fairly compensated and that performers should be asked for consent for any use by AI tools. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
NPR News staffers are also members of SAG-AFTRA, but broadcast journalists are under a different contract. U.S. diplomat and foreign policy scholar Martin Indyk has died of cancer at the age of 73, according to his wife. Indyk served twice as the U.S. ambassador to Israel. He also served as a special assistant to former President Bill Clinton and as a special envoy for former President Barack Obama. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Amazon Business. From small business to big enterprise and everything in between, Amazon Business works to help simplify the supplies buying process. Learn more about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's Friday, and Dan Hoos from Sullivan County Government is here. He is the communications director. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Happy Friday.
To you as well.
We made it. Let's talk about something I mentioned in the opening to the show, an independent audit showing Sullivan County revenues exceeding expenses and why that's a good thing.
Yeah, there's a graph which I'll probably share on social media later today. That an independent auditor provided to us. We get this report every year. In 2023, our revenues basically were almost $240 million. Our expenses were around $220 million. So, of course, that's a good thing. That means that we are stewarding taxpayers' money. Of course, the next thing that people think about as taxpayers is like, well, then when are my taxes going to go down? And I'm going to be brutally honest with that. I'm not seeing that necessarily in the future here, although I'm not in charge of that. But I do know people think about that kind of thing, because what the graph also shows is that expenses continue to slowly tick up while revenues have sort of flattened out since 2022. We, of course, had gotten that COVID money, the American Rescue Plan Act, I think, funding afterwards that really helped revenues in the wake of the pandemic. We also have seen sales tax skyrocket. Just around the pandemic time, sales tax revenues hadn't even topped $40 million a year. Now we're probably going to get between $87 and $90 million this year in sales tax. A lot of it from auto sales. I think I've talked about this before in lumber sales and things. But of course, that can't stay forever. So what goes up must come down at some point. And legislators, while they were very happy to see this yesterday, they also recognize the fact that expenses will continue to rise, but revenues won't necessarily. I mean, that's the bane of everybody's existence, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
And the county is not immune from that. So our county manager, though, Josh Potosik, and the management and budget office, they continue to budget very conservatively. To be perfectly honest, the county portion of your real estate property tax bill is probably one of the smallest, if not the smallest, at least in percentage of it. You know, there are other things that are higher, like the school taxes. So, but listen, we are a part of that issue. And so this is good news that we are continuing to see revenues outpace expenses. And we are going to continue to try to manage the budget so that happens in 2024, 2025, and ongoing from there, at least until whatever next recession hits us. Because sooner or later, these things are cyclical. There will be some sort of downturn in the economy. It's just the way it works. I wish it could sustain itself all the time, but so.
The one way to raise some revenue is to sell some assets that aren't really doing much. You've authorized the sale of the old jail patrol building in Monticello?
Yes, this is what at the time of its closure was the oldest operating jail in the state. It had initially been opened at the same time as the county courthouse was in 1909. That added on over through the years. There's a 1950s edition, there's a 1980s edition, and there's even some what were supposed to be temporary modular additions that ended up being permanent. Plus a patrol building that I think dates back. It was a house in like the 1850s, one of the oldest buildings in Sullivan County, but also one of the most decrepit. I was sort of frightened to walk in there when we were still occupying and operating it. Of course, we have a new jail and a new sheriff's patrol, befitting the work that they do and giving them the space they need in the 21st century over near exit 104. But this property, which is right behind the county courthouse, there had been talk about what are we going to do with it. And in the end, whatever we were going to do with it would have required a demolition that would have been probably in the millions of dollars. So we ended up finding a buyer who wants to create housing there and is willing to put in the money to demolish those structures. So he got it for cheap. It's going to be $100,000 that we sold it for, but he's going to have to put a lot of money into rehabbing the property. And listen, housing is what we really need. And that has been the promise that he has made to us. And we feel comfortable that that is what's going to happen with that property. So the next few months, they're going to have to subdivide the property because currently it's part of the county courthouse. The courthouse is staying county property, but the jail at the patrol building will no longer be county property. And then once that happens and the proper permitting or approvals come from the village of Monticello, then the closing will occur. And then demolition followed by rebuilding of an apartment complex, I believe.
While we're on the subject, we had mentioned this off air, but the Sullivan Correctional Facility, not a county facility, a state facility,
right,
marked for closure by the state. There was a press conference that was held Wednesday. The legislature, are they weighing in at all or will
they?
Oh,
yes. Yes, they're very supportive of the officers, the civilian staff. They are advocating for Sullivan Correctional to stay open. There'll be a resolution probably presented next month to that end. But yes, it's important for people to know because there's been confusion. Sullivan Correctional is a state-run prison in Fallsburg. It is not the Sullivan County Jail and Sheriff's Office in Monticello. That is not under any threat of closure. We just built a new facility there. We are not about to shut it down.
All right, something else we talked about recently, the ethics board and how the legislature is looking at opportunities to potentially outsource that at the state level.
Is yes.
So now where are we in this process?
Well, there's a debate on the legislature right now as to whether it should keep the ethics board that has just been appointed,
right,
and has now started meeting and is a new group of people. And none of the legislators are airing any kind of complaints about them. They appreciate the fact that they volunteered and stood up for which is some tough service it can be sometimes. But there is a concern that in the past, past ethics boards had been weaponized, was the word that was used, against other legislators. So there is talk right now, a debate as to whether or not to keep the current ethics board with the risk that one day it could be weaponized or outsource it up to the state or to another agency to do independent ethics investigations into the county, because there's usually a few ethics investigations every year. A lot of them are unfounded, but some of them are. And the question is that something to be done locally or something beyond? So there's going to be a public hearing on August 15th. That's a Thursday at 10 a.m. In the hearing room of the Government Center in Monticello. We'll be promoting that further for people to weigh in on this. The language is being drafted right now, so hopefully we'll have that to show folks prior to August 15th as to, I think what it's going to say is simply give the legislature the option of, at any time, sticking with the current ethics board or outsourcing the investigation.
And to be clear, they're not opposed to having this oversight, the ethics
not at
board.
All. Everyone agrees it's that there should be.
It's just a process of how it's actually
but
administered.
How is it done? Yeah,
we're speaking to Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government. He is the communications director, joins us every Friday to talk about what the legislature is doing in Monticello and what else is going on at the county level. A resolution opposing OSHA's new emergency response standards was passed. And a reminder, OSHA proposed new emergency response standards in April to update and expand workplace protections for emergency responders. It replaces the existing fire brigade standards, which was published in 1980 and only covered firefighters. This expands this, but some say that the proposed standards lack specific definitions and could be detrimental to these departments, all of these folks that might be covered.
the big issue for our local fire departments and the leaders of the county is that the way it's written, it really assumes that our fire departments are much larger and wealthier than they are, that the average fire department budget is around $1.7 million a year. Well, the fire department budgets around here are usually a tenth of that, around $100,000 a year. Could be less, could be more. And the requirements for training and more equipment and more really staff, actually paid staff, would be devastating to the finances of these fire departments and would require virtually for all of our 40 fire departments one of two things, either increasing their budgets, which are taxpayer funded, I might add, by up to 40 some percent, or shutting down, which would either one would be catastrophic. And we are saying to the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, we need more time to take a look at this and figure out something that is fair for the smaller fire departments and emergency response organizations, because I'm sure the last thing OSHA wants is to put them out of business. What they're going for is making it safer and better firefighters. I get that. And the legislators get that. But it's being done in a way that is, frankly, the way the legislature feels is blind to the needs and challenges faced by small rural fire departments. So they've put out this resolution to oppose these rules and saying, let's have a little more time with this. So we'll find out. The public comment period just closed on Monday, so we don't know anything yet.
Yeah, and the statement from the legislature, the resolution is in line with the National Volunteer Fire Council, who said that, you know, while these provisions would be helpful to improve safety of emergency responders, many of the new requirements would be very burdensome and in many cases impossible for volunteer and emergency service fire departments to comply with. This week, though, OSHA has set a hearing on that emergency response standard for September 12th. So there's more to come there. Let's talk about some other issues that are going on in the legislature. Leadership development training that has been approved for staff, that there was some discussion about this, it seems.
Yes. Really what the debate centered on was about legislators. The training for staff, I was part of the first round of training, which I found wonderful. I thought it was very good. We had about 130 county employees, little over probably about 12% of our workforce participated. And it was 8 hours for six meetings. So, yeah, that was eight meetings. Excuse me. It was 64 hours total. So legislators, of course, some of them like, I can't give that much time for the leadership training. And then that sort of morphed into a larger debate about the cost and was this effective, et cetera, et cetera. Well, thankfully, in the end, legislators, the majority agreed that staff should continue to be afforded this. It's about $150,000 for a training of between 130, 150 staff. But I think we're already starting to see the fruits of that, especially because there's been a lot of cross-pollination now between departments that otherwise wouldn't know one another or work with one another that these meetings have brought together. Plus, it's about how to be more efficient and understand everybody's individual work styles. I'm, for example, the kind of guy who likes to go into the office and talk about how your weekend went and just be friendly and happy. And other people are like, I just want to get my work done. So we are learning how to recognize and accommodate one another that way as well. But I think legislators, they're still trying to figure out exactly where and when they're going to take it. But I am happy to say more staff will be afforded this opportunity with the hope that eventually the entire amount of staff who are willing and interested to participate can.
And there was an authorization to solicit expressions of interest from waste to energy firms. Is this related to that trip you took out to Long Island?
Yes.
Or the waste to energy?
Yes. Yeah, this we had taken that trip, what was it, May, June?
Yeah.
To Long Island, in fact, the densest part of Long Island, it seemed, right around the Roosevelt Field Mall area. And there's this company called ReWorld, formerly Covanta, that actually burns garbage that is regulated by the state to a degree that they say that there's little to no pollution coming out of their smokestacks. So this intrigued legislators. It's like, well, you know, we're going to have to figure out something to do with our trash if the landfill that we currently export it to upstate closes, which there's a very high probability of that happening. And it's New York State's basically adopted, Seneca Meadows, as what we've been told is New York State has basically adopted the no more landfills policy for the county. And we agree, that's not really sustainable. In fact, I think eventually we'll be digging up our landfills to recycle and reclaim some of the stuff that we put in there years ago. But what else can we do with it besides sticking it in the ground? So there are other alternatives. Just because the legislature is looking to waste to energy doesn't mean that's what they're going to go with. There were already members of the public who were saying, not so sure that this is a good idea. They feel it would just be, you know, an incinerator in their backyard kind of thing. ReWorld says we're different from your standard incinerator, but there's more research to be done. And that's one of the reasons they asked for these expressions of interest, which is to give the legislature the ability to take a look at the companies that do offer these kinds of services, how they offer it, what their history is, how they're regulated, and whether this would be an appropriate fit, probably for our old landfill property in Monticello if it were to go anywhere. But we're talking about something that is years away and that the public will have plenty of time to weigh in on. This is not something that's imminent. This is simply asking for companies that are interested to tell us more about themselves.
And there is, you know, opposition to that claims that it's dirtier than coal burning and worse than directly using landfills. So,
yep. And that was brought up by some members of the public. And I know there are several legislators that are taking a very skeptical, hard eye to all of this. But let's focus on the point here that we have to figure out what we're going to do next. We can't sit and do nothing or just say, well, that won't work. That won't work. That won't work. We got to figure out something that will work. So it's time for legislators to start doing their homework, and that's what they've begun.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, more with Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government. You're listening to Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org, and from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Aaron Bendich. Join me for Borscht Beat, the Jewish music show on Radio Catskill. Each week I share rare, forgotten, and classic recordings from Jewish musical traditions across multiple generations. From Yiddish folk songs to instrumental klezmer, Yiddish theater, and contemporary performances. It's a grand tour of many musical landscapes. That's Borscht Beat, an hour of Jewish music in the Catskills, Sunday afternoons at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. We're continuing our conversation with Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government. He's the communications director. And I wanted to mention that the strategic plan for the legislature has been adopted.
Yeah, it's the strategic plan actually for the whole county. The legislature adopted it yesterday. It's marked 2024, but it really looks ahead into the future for the next 1 to 5 years. It's available for people to review. I have it under our helpful links on the county website. Something I put together with the county manager, and then we had commissioners weigh in. And it's the goals that the county would like to accomplish over the next few years. It's actually quite illuminating, and it's something that I think most taxpayers and residents would find interesting to read, especially since it has some ideas in there that probably haven't really been discussed much in public yet because they're sort of pie in the sky or a little too far away. But it's good to see because this is the county's hopes and dreams, and residents should know what we're looking at.
Job fair at social services this Wednesday. That was postponed because of some rain.
Yep. Yeah, we had, I think, some heavy-duty thunderstorms come through last Wednesday. I think my mom got like 3.5 inches of rain in like an hour or two, she said. So we didn't want people standing out in the rain. We want to do it outside, although this time we've worked it out that if there is rain, that we will move it inside. But it's 3 to 6 p.m. this Wednesday at our social services campus off of Sunset Lake Road in Liberty. We have a lot of different interesting open positions perfect for people who want to help others. That's what it's about.
And Emergency Services Youth Academy is concluding today. This is that program for younger folks to get involved with emergency services.
This has been an awesome been week. People, when people come into the office and said, "Where's Dan?" and they've been telling him, "Oh, he's out having fun." But it has been, because these teens have had a chance to see like a state police helicopter land, and they get to tour. They got to sit in the pilot seat. They got to see our sheriff's office, their Bearcat and their drones, and they actually saw a flash bomb go off, how that goes. I don't think my ears have recovered yet from that. They got to break open a door. They got to do CPR on these mannequins, adult and baby mannequins. They got to see a Stokes basket, which I didn't know what that is. That's one of those baskets where you've seen people can be hauled out of a steep terrain. Uh-huh. Either by a rope or by a pulley from a helicopter or something. Today, the LifeNet medical helicopter is going to be there, and we're going to give them some certificates of achievement for it. We had 7 who ended up participating this year. I think after I put out more of the videos and the photos that I've been putting out, we are going to have a lot more applicants for next year's version, because this was, if I had been a teen and this had been offered, I would have wanted to participate so badly in this. It was really cool. And they come away with it with their own helmet, safety glasses, gloves, and a new knowledge and appreciation of what our police, our firefighters, and our EMS folks do. And hopefully, and it sounds like we're headed in that direction, it encourages and inspires them to become part, as mm-hmm. they get older, to be a part of our emergency response agencies.
I think I noticed that helicopter this week out and about, the police helicopter. Was wondering mm-hmm. what was going on. So this yep. seems to be leading to that. The answer to that.
That's what they were doing.
Do you know why it was called the Stokes Basket?
No, why?
First exhibited at the St. Louis World's Fair in 1904, the Stokes Basket was conceived by the U.S. Navy physician Charles Francis Stokes, who in the Spanish-American War witnessed firsthand the difficulties of transporting the wounded through narrow gangways and such. So Stokes Basket.
How interesting. Yeah, and it's still in use here over 100 years later.
There you go. The youth are learning about it. That's good. Commitment to just over $500,000 to ensure that the Never Sink Crossing gets built along the O&W Rail Trail. There was a bit of a funding gap there.
Yes, we had gotten a whole bunch of grants, actually $2.6 million plus from federal, state, local, and private funding. But we still needed about $550 million more, because it's just over a $3 million project.
$550,000.
$550,000. Did I say million?
I did, didn't I? Taxpayers
that
are listening, we all dropped their tea and was like, what?
It's like on the news this morning, they talked about a new Corvette debuting, and the woman who was reporting on it, she says, and it's the fastest ever. It's got 100,000 horsepower. It was 1,000 horsepower, 100,000 horsepower. We'd be off to Mars. So I just did the same thing. All right. Sorry about that. Thank you.
000, just over a half thousand.
It's over $3 million project
total
to create a pedestrian and bicycle friendly bridge where the O&W Railroad Bridge used to span the Neversink River between Woodridge and South Fallsburg. It will connect two trails that already exist. I think we're also going to be soon dedicating a tunnel bypass trail, because it's right near the Fallsburg Tunnel, which is not safe to walk through, so we want people to walk around it. So we're really putting a lot of effort, time, and money into these trails, which have been a boon to the local economy. And certainly this bridge, I think, will become, somebody said, sort of our mini version of walkway over the Hudson.
All right. And before we go, bagels and lox. Tomorrow we're talking about lox for the bagels, but also the lox, L-O-C-K-S, mm-hmm. on the river. Tell us about the canal. I was fascinated to learn more about this, that the coal from Honesdale used to come down in this sort of gravity system and then in through all of these locks down mm-hmm. the canal at the turn of the century.
It was America's first $1 billion enterprise.
Yeah.
I would say it was the region's first superhighway, if mm-hmm. you will, even though the canal boats probably didn't go faster than a couple miles an hour. But in its heyday, it was the main method of transport, and it went through Sullivan County. In fact, where our Canal Interpretive Center is, where this bagels and locks thing will be happening tomorrow at noon, is in Summitville, so named because it was the summit of the canal. On one side, the canal waters fell away towards the Delaware watershed, and on the other side, they fell away towards the Hudson River watershed. But of course, since it wasn't all level ground, that's why these locks were put in place where they could actually manually, not automatically, raise and lower water levels for the canal boats to continue on their journey. So this will be a fascinating conversation about some very ancient technology, over 200 years old. And of course, lock technology goes back far, much farther than that, back to Egyptian times. And you'll also get some tasty bagels and locks with it.
Right. Dan, who's Sullivan County Government, thank you for joining us again. Have a great weekend.
My pleasure. You too.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, a new detailed map of Big Eddie in Narrowsburg. A local resident wanted to know how truly deep it was, so she decided to make her own map. This is Radio Chatskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
The demonization of fact-based journalism is one of democracy's biggest threats, as the number of local newsrooms has dwindled, leaving disinformation to fill the void. This station is an oasis amid all the noise and fiction by building bridges and holding people to account. We do it thanks to you. You give us the tools we need to fight attacks on truth by donating to this station. Here's how.
Give what you can at wjffradio.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. When Lisa Glover visited Narrowsburg last year and looked out at Big Eddie, or the deeps of the Delaware River, she wondered just how truly deep it was. To find out, she decided to create an updated map that would reveal the true features of this section of the river. Radio Catskill's Patricio Rubio spoke with Lisa about her process of creating this detailed map of the deeps.
Narrowsburg is one of my favorite places to visit, and I had heard about how it was both the site of the narrowest and the deepest part of the Delaware River, but there's this kiosk on this beautiful overlook that Narrowsburg has. And on the kiosk, it shows a profile image of the deepest area, but I couldn't figure out exactly where it was. There were some trees on either side of this image and this embankment. And as much as I tried to compare that to the landscape, there was no way that it seemed to make sense. And so I figured I wanted to solve this mystery because I wanted to know more about how this could be the deepest and like why even that might be.
And so that curiosity took you to go about and to create this map. Now, this is not like we talked offline, but it's not such your forte. You create artwork using different tools. You're also known as Lisa the Maker. Now you got this idea. You want to know how deep this water is. So what were the next steps for you?
Yeah, the next steps for me was, especially since I don't have phone access, internet access in Narrowsburg, I walked up to the Upper Delaware Council office, where I know that they have a lot of resources related to the Delaware River, and I wanted to see if maybe they or another group nearby had any maps or any bathymetric maps of this part of the river. But we have in our bathroom a topo bathymetric map of the Prompton Dam area, so it seemed logical that, of course, something as cool as this much bigger, much more important feature would have one. And they said no, they didn't have one, but they had a couple little articles about the deeps. And so Lori over at the Upper Delaware Council was able to send me one of those, and it had this little tidbit of information from the author that they were back in this one article from 1993 that talked about the deeps. Mentioned that one of their hopes in creating that article was that folks who were doing USGS mapping work would be able to do some sort of map of the deeps to shed some light on why this geological feature is so high up in the Delaware River as it is. For your information, a lot of the deepest areas of many rivers around the world, it's closer to the end of the river. So for ours to be so high up, so early on in the river, is certainly an anomaly. So from there, I looked for a bunch of keywords on Google related to mapping the Delaware River, and I stumbled upon a USGS researcher who had done a LIDAR scan of the whole upper Delaware. And I reached out to him to ask if he had any of that data in a way that I could process, in a way that visually made sense. And a month later, he got back to me and was able to provide me a really cool LIDAR-based picture that showed where the deepest area was in the deeps.
But what are some of the biggest challenges you're facing creating this new map? You had to get the information. You were looking for information that wasn't there. I'm surprised that this person had this information and other organizations didn't use it.
Yeah, that was what surprised me too. We have so many incredible organizations who care about and work with this part of the Delaware River. And I was really shocked that none of them had any of this information that I found from this researcher. It felt like, even from a safety perspective, that knowing the terrain of that area underwater could be really helpful in the case of something large that's lost, or in the case of a rescue. But really, the biggest challenge was just honestly waiting to understand, to get the answer to this mystery. And actually, regarding the mystery and this profile image that's on the kiosk in Narrowsburg, the reason that kiosk image doesn't match up to anything that made sense to me as someone experiencing the area around Narrowsburg is because that image was taken from that article I mentioned about that was written in 1993. But that image was originally made for a print newsletter. So on the image in the newsletter, they explained that this profile image has been shrunk horizontally by 10 times to be able to fit on the page. And so that's why it looks, when you look at it on the kiosk in Narrowsburg, it looks extremely deep. It's not nearly 113 feet might seem like it's pretty deep, and it certainly is. But when you're looking at an area that's maybe 400 feet wide, it doesn't look nearly as dramatic as it actually is, except when crunch it down to be able to fit on a page. The kiosk in Narrowsburg didn't have that information about the profile being scrunched. And so that's really why this was this image was such a mystery. It was based on some people's experience of diving in that area, but without that context of why it was scrunched, it made this information about this being the narrowest area and the deepest area hard to understand.
Now, let's learn a little bit about you. First of all, I want to just make point that the LIDAR system, for those who don't know, because I didn't know what the LIDAR system technology was. It's called the light detection ranging, and it's a remote sensing type of technology that uses laser to measure distances, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So now let's talk about you. Like I say, you are not a map maker by trade. You have a website called Lisa the Maker. What got it? Let's talk about your history as far as where did you graduate and how did you get into sort of the work that you do now?
Yeah, sure thing. So I'm originally from the Doylestown area of Pennsylvania. I came up to what I like to call the Lackawaxen Valley in 2017 for a job, and ended up staying here just after that job ended, just because I loved the place so much and I wanted to figure out how to make it work and had to spend time in this incredible community that I've been calling home for the past 7 or so years. And I do a wide variety, or I have done a wide variety of building and design work. But right now I have the grand privilege of getting to do what's called placemaking with a group called the Center on Rural Innovation. which basically means I help folks in other rural towns make people-powered public spaces, places where people get to have their voices heard in the design process, which helps to save communities money and helps local people want to be more involved in the public spaces they call home.
Actually, Lisa, I had a question about the Center for Rural Innovation. You said it focuses on advancing rural economics. How does you think your project that you did with for the map, how does it align with the sort of the broader mission, and what impact do you hope it will have on the local community?
Yeah, so I did this map. I did this map for free just because it was something that was felt very important to me, that this mystery needed to be solved and be more clearly out there. So it's not necessarily part of the work that I do on a daily basis, but I would say that just in general, a lot of people don't know about the places, details about the histories of the places that they live. One of the communities I'm working with in Vermont, for example, folks who work downtown didn't realize just how big of a rail hub it was and how that's affected the entire design of their downtown. Same thing with a community I'm working with in rural Arkansas. The Arkansas River and the way it's shifted over time has drastically changed how the town is arranged. And so having an understanding in Narrowsburg of the context of this river that, you know, that their lives are shaped by feels very important to me.
Now, you mentioned the importance of understanding the river's depths from a safety perspective. Can you elaborate on that and how this new map can help improve safety for residents and visitors?
Sure. Let me start by saying that I don't have any diving experience. Or water rescue experience, but I can say, just as someone who loves to paddleboard and swim in the Narrowsburg area, that having an understanding of where the deepest areas are helps me to know, for example, where the eddy might be and where I might get stuck if the water is whirlpooling, as can happen in the deepest area. And I haven't done any jumps from any rocks in Narrowsburg, but for those people who do, knowing where the water is 10 feet deep or 20 feet deep or 30 feet deep might be important to know if you're looking to safely make a jump for fun. So I would hope that it has value to folks who are doing water rescue. I haven't talked to those folks yet, so I don't want to speak for them. But I think that it could be valuable, because if you can see where the contours are, where you might be able to have a better idea of where, say, an object that is floating or is near the bottom of the river might get hung up on, which might make it easier to find.
So what has been the response from the community and local people since you released the new map? And are there any steps for getting it more widely recognized or used?
A lot of people have been really excited about it. I know quite a few people who don't live in Narrowsburg anymore, but maybe grew up there, who told me how wonderful it was to get to see a place that they knew very well in a new way. And it's been something that is for sale at the Upper Delaware Council or for donation. And it's also for sale with all the proceeds going back to the Upper Delaware Council at the Ruff de Grouse Art Gallery in Narrowsburg. My hope for it is that it continues to inform folks about this cool geographic feature and also clean up the confusion of that the narrowest part of the river is not the deepest part, and that the deepest part actually follows a couple hundred feet after the narrowest part. I guess if I'm really dreaming, it would be really cool for the confusing profile image on the kiosk in Narrowsburg to be replaced with a profile image that is accurate, given that they have a lot more space than the size of a newsletter. But I know that processes like that can be a little bit more challenging and expensive to change.
Another question is, I see you have twin rabbits. I love rabbits. What are your twin rabbits' names?
They're named Twigs and Pebble, and they're mini Rex rabbits.
Oh, that's beautiful. worry. I used to have a rabbit myself, so that's fine.
Oh, yeah, that's cool. What was your rabbit's name?
His name was Oscar.
Oh,
yeah. Unfortunately, he passed away a couple of years ago, but I didn't know anything about rabbits when I first got them. And it just made, I just fell in love with the rabbit. It was like a fantastic pet to have.
Yeah, absolutely. They are, I feel as a placemaker, I find that they're such a great example of just how people, in this case, animals, will just, if they don't like something or if they will adjust it to make it into something that they like. So even if it's a cardboard box, if there's not an entrance where they want it to be, they will chew one. It's the same thing with, I think they call them desire paths, where if there isn't a walkway to get between two places that people want to go, they'll make a path. You'll see it worn through the grass into the dirt.
Yeah.
And so it's just a great way to show how people will figure out how to make their environment better for them and the way that their lives go.
Yeah, that's so. It's what it seems like what you do with your life. And speaking on you, I know you have the day job, but anything coming up for you in the future as far as anything else that you're making?
I've been thinking about making a large map of the Lackawaxen River watershed. I like to think about the world in relation to watershed. I think it's an interesting way of looking at boundaries and thinking about how we care for our natural spaces. Any water that flows through one top part of the watershed is going to affect the lower parts of the watershed. And so I thought that since we rarely think about the Lackawaxen watershed, that it could be interesting for us to see, those of us in the Wayne County, Pike County area, could be interesting for us to be able to think about this area as one whole place that where one thing, something that happens in one place is affects something that happens downriver.
Lisa, if those who want to purchase the poster, where can they purchase this?
On weekdays, they're able to purchase one at the Upper Delaware Council office on, I think, Bridge Street in Narrowsburg. And then on weekends, you can find them at the Ruffed Grouse Gallery.
And we talked about the potential hope that this could be make it onto the kiosk there in Narrowsburg, right?
Absolutely. Heck, if there was a chance for me to get it to be able to redesign the kiosk, I would jump at that opportunity to be able to make sure that anyone who gets to overlook the Delaware at Narrowsburg has a chance to really understand where that deepest part is and what the profile of the deepest area and the narrowest area look like together.
Lisa, before we go, is there anything else we have not touched on you want folks to know about?
No, I think we got everything.
Like I said, Lisa,
thank you.
No problem. We'll talk to Lisa Glover, Lisa, the maker, about the new map that shows the deepest part of the Big Eddy, part of the Delaware River, which is the Delaware River, such an important part in our area. So I do appreciate you taking the time and really making this map, because I think it would be good for not only for what's happening now and locals here, but for generations ahead to see this work has been done and the care that has been done to make it come alive. So I do really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Thank you so much.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Robayo for Radio Catskill.
We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, from Bach to rock, pushing the limits of the acoustic instrument to achieve the sounds of jazz, rock and roll, tangos, Broadway, and more, Classical Kid is here. This is Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, an effort to remind the country of the humanity in all of us. I'm Isabel Braverman, and we are pairing up strangers in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania to have conversations, not debates. Get to know your neighbors. Let's take one small step away from division and toward each other. Sign up at WJFFradio.org.
StoryCorps' One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
It's Radio Catskill. Liberty Public Library is presenting Bach to Rock, an evening of cello music, Thursday, August 1st, with Hudson Valley-based historian and musician Alex Prisgintis. And here to tell us more is Classical Kit and Alex, joining us by phone. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. Thank you for having me this morning.
Yeah, and thank you so much for joining us, Alex. You know, when I look at all your accomplishments, the word that comes to mind is synthesis, because you've taken diverse interests and talents and combined them to create lectures and exhibits and articles and podcasts and concerts where you share all those interests with a wider audience. And you've described your concerts as a journey that links history and harmony. And I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners how you came to develop these musical programs.
The word synthesis you've chosen, it's the first time I've actually anyone have used that word to describe my work. And I think it's a great word because, as you said, we look to combine history and harmony. I started going professionally on the road with these concerts back now almost 3 years ago. And the original concerts focused purely on my sound, which is rather unique. I play on a classical cello in addition to being classically trained. But I like to, what I say, expand the boundaries of the instrument. And primarily, I do this through using a looping station, which allows me to either play and record pre-arranged compositions live, as well as also recording live in front of the audience, essentially creating the sensation of a one-man band. And some of the compositions in Bach to Rock will have that effect. In addition to the looping station, I also use an array of the guitar effect pedals popular in rock and roll bands, whether it be a delay pedal for a reverberated sound, a distortion pedal indicative of rock and roll guitars, or even the iconic wah-wah pedal of 1960s and 70s rock and roll bands. And coming into the synthesis aspect, as stated before, the original programs focused almost entirely on that sound. But in another aspect of my work, as you hinted at, I'm also a historical lecturer on different topics of the past in the Hudson Valley. Particularly, I like to focus on more neglected aspects, in my opinion, of Hudson Valley history. And I wanted to create a unique experience where I could tie in those themes of local history and history in general with the music I play, almost sharing those perhaps neglected and forgotten stories about how many of these classic selections were made and also connected. So with my partner, each of the performances we play, generally for an hour's performance, is anywhere from 12 to 14 selections combined with these narrations. We like to combine history and harmony, sharing some of these interesting and perhaps forgotten tales of how these selections were made. And key to that point is also showing how different pieces have connections over time. In the case of Bach to Rock, there are two great examples. We cover briefly Bach's famed air on a G string and how that influenced its, particularly its chordal pattern known as a walking bass, influenced Procol Harum's 1967 Whiter Shade of Pale. And another great example, a little more unique, comes from Paul McCartney's Blackbird, which he stated in an interview. The chordal progression for Blackbird came from an inspiration from the Borés from Bach's Lute Suite in E minor. Those who know the band Jethro Tull will also know the Boré quite well. So it's linking those themes of history and harmony together. We like to develop an immersive experience that has our audience walking away with something new, perhaps an inspiration both in the musical aspect as well as in terms of knowledge and history.
Well, I have to put in here that this is right up my alley because I host a program called Something Old, Something New, and I did a show a few years ago where I took those Beatles, a whole series of Beatles songs, Golden Slumbers and Blackbird, and played the classical things that kind of informed that work. So I'm really looking forward to next Thursday night and seeing how you combine these pieces together. It's just great.
I'm very much looking forward to it as well. And it's actually fitting that we're coming. I go on the road anywhere from about 140 to 150 times a year, but this is the first time a Bach to Rock selection, which is the original of now more than 12 different, programs that I advertise under the branding Uber Arts, Delivering Food for the Soul. Some of my other popular programs include the British Invasion, Rock and Roll of the 60s and 70s, America, Songs of Patriotism, Protest, and Praise. There is Valentine's Day, Sharing Songs of Love, Winter Holidays for the Cello. But Bach to Rock in particular, I find special for Sullivan County because the name is derived from what was going to be essentially a spin-off of the 1969 Woodstock Festival. There was a second, concert or music venue that was going to be held in Mountaindale, titled under the name Bach to Rock, with a similarly, you might say, eclectic lineup of performers, including Grand Funk Railroad, Jethro Tull, Mountain, some of those same bands that performed at Woodstock. So I'm really thrilled that the Liberty Public Library could host me for this and that we get to have that Sullivan County historical connection embedded in this performance.
Well, that's great because I've been seeing, you know, in the publication Canvas announcements of your concerts over the years, but they're always like a little too far away from me. So the fact that you're coming right down the road in Liberty from our station is great for us and for our listeners. You know, I just want to touch just lightly on what I consider an extraordinary talent you have, which is synesthesia, where you actually can see color that goes with sound. And I'm wondering, when you're preparing a concert, do you kind of see the range of color that's going to be in that concert?
So that's a great question, and it's always hard to visualize because, for instance, with synesthesia itself, you know, like many things, it might be inherent as a habit, perhaps. It's not something you perhaps realize you have until you learn about it. For me, synesthesia takes on two different forms. The one, which is more prominent, as I've heard discussing other people who have synesthesia, is that sequences are associated with colors, put simply. So, for instance, every month of the year for me has a color associated. Every number has a color associated. Every musical tone, musical pitch has a color associated with it. When it comes to performing or perhaps memorizing a composition, it's slightly different. Essentially, what happens is there's a roadmap that's envisioned within my head. It's a very immersive experience, you could say. I can almost feel emotionally the different paths through which the musical selection will take. One of the best examples, I would say, though it won't be performed in this Bach to Rock performance, but it is in some other. One of the pieces in my repertoire is Goltermann's Concerto in G major. And there are different movements, of course, throughout that concerto. And in each different movement, there is a distinctly different emotion. Now, when it comes to that, I will also add, I do have to be careful on a personal note. When it comes to memorizing, I am quite quick at memorizing the notes and music itself. I also do have perfect pitch, so that goes hand in hand. But I do have to be careful to pay attention to certain things like bowings or dynamics, those who are fluent in the musical field who, of course, know the importance of these. So it's a very careful balance between both my memorization skills and also staying tried and true to the method of reading sheet music and making sure that all those different details are abided by.
Well, it's a lot of balls in the air that you're juggling, just as you have so many different interests that are just fascinating to me. And I'm hoping that this will not be the only time that we get to speak to you about some of your interests and talents, because there's way more than we have time for this morning. I just want to reiterate the details of this concert so that people know that it is going to be at the Liberty Library on Main Street. And the library always recommends that people go onto their website and register, because there are, I believe, 32 seats available, but often these concerts get filled up pretty quickly. So Liberty Public Library, I think if you go to, you don't need the whole long thing. I think if you just do libertypubliclibrary.com.
.org.
Or .org, sorry, it will take you there. So that you can register and get to hear Alex with this wonderful concert. I will definitely be there, and I'm looking forward to it. Alex, is there anything else you'd like us to know?
I think you covered everything quite well. I would just like to take a moment to thank you for promoting the work of other artists and activists in this region of Sullivan County.
Well, thank you so much. And to learn more about Alex, you can go to alexprisgintas.com and learn about some of your other activities, your lectures and other things. So thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for giving me some of your morning and some time to promote my work.
Thank you, Alex, and thank you, Classical Kit. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. We'll see you at the Borscht Belt Festival in Ellenville and the Calicoon Country Fair in Calicoon tomorrow, and Riverfest in Narrowsburg on Sunday. Busy weekend. We look forward to seeing you. Come by our booth and say hi. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Furniture Restore, located on Main Street in Jeffersonville. specializing in antique and vintage furniture, rugs, art, and lighting. Because buying well-made and pre-owned is a better choice for the planet. Online at therestorejville.com. And from The River Reporter, the community newspaper serving four counties along the Delaware River in Pennsylvania and New York. RiverReporter.com. And from listeners like you.
How we make sense of the news and the world keeps changing. Who to trust and what's real are other moving targets. Let On the Media be your guide.
Saturday afternoon at 4.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, mostly sunny and nice, a high of 78. Clear tonight, low 54. Looks like a nice weekend as well. 81 tomorrow, mostly sunny. Plenty of sun Sunday and warming up to 85. We might see the humidity and a couple of thunderstorms returning Monday night into Tuesday. On Point is next from WBUR Boston. This is